Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jeff Farber, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, Chief Executive Officer of the Corrett Foundation, and your chair for this program. Today's program is underwritten by the Corrett Foundation as part of the Commonwealth Club's Principles of a Free Society series. The program will feature Dr. Condoleezza Rice, former U.S. Secretary of State and author of the new book, Extraordinary Ordinary People, a memoir of family, in conversation with Mary Cranston, past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and senior partner at the law firm Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman. Dr. Rice served as America's chief diplomat from 2005 to 2009 during George W. Bush's second term in office. Prior to that, she was national security advisor during Bush's first term. Since leaving Washington, Dr. Rice has joined Stanford University as a professor of business and political science and is the Thomas and Barbara Stevenson Senior Fellow on public policy at the Hoover Institution. She is hardly a stranger to the Stanford campus. Dr. Rice first joined the faculty as a professor of political science in 1981 and served as its provost and senior fellow at the Hoover Institution throughout the 90s. She was so effective in her role as a professor that she won two of the university's highest teaching honors. But Dr. Rice's achievements aren't limited to politics and academics. She has served on boards of directors for Chevron, Charles Schwab, Transamerica Corporation, and was vice president of the Boys and Girls Club of the Peninsula. Currently, she sits on the boards of the Boys and Girls Club of America and the Commonwealth Club, and is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Dr. Rice has also been involved in many humanitarian pursuits, most notably with the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and in creating and serving on the board of the Millennium Challenge Corporation. Both of these organizations have increased aid to developing countries and to the world's poorest, most disadvantaged populations. And lest we forget, Dr. Rice is also an accomplished pianist. Now she has added author to her impressive resume with the publication of her new book. This memoir pays homage to her strong creative forebears, an extended family of ministers, orators, and educators that included one of the first African-American women to receive a PhD. In particular, and most notably, she honors her parents, John and Angelina Rice, who made countless sacrifices to afford their only child the best chance at success. I think we all agree their efforts paid off. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. Condoleezza Rice in conversation with Mary Cranston.
Well, welcome, Dr. Rice.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed your book. It was a wonderful peek into your childhood and the early years of your career. Maybe we could start by having you talk a little bit about your parents, because not everyone's had a chance to read the book yet. And they were really exceptional. I told Dr. Rice, I thought she'd won the lottery in parents. But just to give them sort of an overview so they can understand the rest of the conversation.
Certainly. Well, the way to describe my parents is that they were in many ways quite ordinary people. My mother was a school teacher, first an English teacher, and by the way, one of her early students was Willie Mays. And she used to say to him, according to Willie Mays, he told me this, you're going to be a ball player, son, and so if you have to leave class a little bit early, you go right ahead and do that. So she was an English teacher, later a science teacher. My father was a football coach when I was born, then later on a high school guidance counselor, Presbyterian minister, and ultimately a university administrator. And so in that sense, they were quite ordinary people, and I doubt that they ever made more than about $60,000 between them. But what made them extraordinary was, first of all, that they were growing up themselves and then ultimately raising a family in segregated Birmingham, Alabama, a quite extraordinary place. I've called Birmingham really the most segregated big city in America. A place where you couldn't go to a restaurant, where you couldn't stay in a hotel until you got to Washington, D.C. And yet, within this place with very limited horizons, they somehow had their little girl convinced that she might not be able to have a hamburger at the Woolworth's lunch counter, but if she wanted to be president of the United States, that was perfectly fine and capable, and she was capable of doing it. So in that sense, they were extraordinary.
One of the things I found really cute in the book was that you were actually elected president of your family.
Yes.
And
yes.
What was at three?
I was from age four, the president of the Rice family. I knew that I was assured re-election because my mother always voted for me, and we did not have term limits, so I was president of the family for a long time. But in fact, it was in retrospect now, looking back, my parents giving me a sense of responsibility. So, for instance, if we were going to have a family vacation, I had to call a family meeting to arrange the time of departure and what were we going to make as a picnic lunch, because if you were traveling through the South, you couldn't stop in a restaurant. And so my mother would get up and make fried chicken and pork chops and everything that wouldn't spoil. So it was my job to organize all of that through meetings. When we moved to the little house that was our first real house, after I was born, we lived in the back of the church for about 3 years. I was the one who organized the move and what color were the rooms going to be painted and that sort of thing. So it had real responsibility, president of the family.
That is really amazing. So you mentioned that Birmingham was extremely segregated when you were growing up, and in the book you almost describe a parallel universe that you were in, and that your parents and your extended family and your friends really were sheltering the younger generation to some extent. Could you kind of describe that a little bit?
Yes, I was fortunate to live in a little enclave, really a little suburb of Birmingham, although downtown Birmingham was just maybe 10 minutes away. It was called Titusville, and it had a long heritage as a little black middle-class enclave where I think there was one lawyer, one doctor, and everybody else taught school. And this was a place where education was everything. I've always believed that for my parents and their friends, education was a kind of talisman against everything bad. It was armor against the harshness of racism. So if you could speak English perfectly and you could play the piano and you were a good student, then they, which is what the white man was called in a kind of depersonalized way, they may not like you, but they would have to respect you. And it might mean that you had to be twice as good, which we were told all the time, you have to be twice as good. And by the way, it was said not as a matter for debate. It was just said. And so this little enclave gave us ballet lessons and French lessons and etiquette lessons. In fact, etiquette lessons that I was very glad I'd had when I went to those White House dinners. You know, I knew which fork to use and so forth. So that was a little parallel universe because you couldn't, of course, go to ballet lessons or movie theaters or anything of the like in Birmingham proper. But it was actually a very comfortable place to grow up in that sense.
I think you also mentioned that your family tended to be teachers or pastors, and that was in the Black community of the time the highest aspiration, probably yes. the highest level you could yes. reach.
Well, for both men and women in the Black community, it's been said in the community at large that women had few other options in my parents' generation, whatever race you were, and so most women became teachers if they were going to be professionals. This was also true for Black men to a certain extent. Few went to law school, a few went to medical school, but for the most part, the highest profession was to be a teacher, and the pinnacle of that was to be a principal of a high school or of an elementary school, so that the most important man in the whole city of Birmingham was a man named Mr. R.C. Johnson in the Black community, Mr. R.C. Johnson, who was Alma Powell, Colin Powell's wife's father. And Colin Powell's wife's uncle was George C. Bell, who was the principal at Ullman High School, the second largest Black school in Birmingham. So these people were giants in the community.
And your grandfather, I think it's your paternal grandfather,
yes.
was also a well-known pastor
yes.
and educator, influential in your life. Maybe you could talk about him
sure.
a little bit.
Sure. Well, we all have our heroes from our families. And one of ours, most important ones, John Wesley Rice Sr. And John Wesley Rice Sr. was actually a sharecropper's son in Utah. That would be E-U-T-A-W, Alabama. And he decided when he was about 19 years old that he wanted to get book learning in a college. And so he asked how a colored man could go to college, and they told him about Little Stillman College, which was a little Presbyterian school 30 minutes from where he lived. So he went off to college, saved his cotton to pay for his college, and after 1 year, they said, so how are you going to pay for your second year? And he said, well, I'm out of cotton and out of money. They said, then you're out of luck. And he said, thinking quickly, he said, but how are those boys going to college? And they said, well, they have what's called a scholarship. And if you wanted to be a Presbyterian minister, then you could have a scholarship too. And my grandfather said, that is exactly what I had in mind. And my family has been college educated and Presbyterian, by the way, ever since. And so he was really the first to be college educated. He then went on to educate my father, who ended up as a university administrator, and my aunt, whom you mentioned, my Aunt Teresa, who was a woman, one of the first Black women to receive a PhD from the University of Wisconsin in 1952 in Victorian literature. She wrote books on Dickens, of all things. And so that side of the family was educated. My grandfather was a kind of educational evangelist. He would found a church, and then next door he would found the school. And after a while he would move along and he'd found another church and another school. And he would go door to door in these communities and say to parents, you know, your daughter is smart or your son is smart, and I'm going to get your son or your daughter a scholarship at Tuskegee or Alabama State, and I want you to send your daughter or your son to college. And he grew up generations, in that generation, scores and scores and scores of people who actually then got educated thanks to his efforts. And when he died 2 months before I was born. He died September 14, 1954. I was born November 14, 1954. He still remained in our family this giant of a figure. He was such an intellectual that at the height of the Great Depression, he bought 9 leather-bound, gold-embossed books. And when my grandmother, who had been struggling to make ends meet, said to him, so how much did you pay for these books? He said, oh, don't worry, they cost $90, height of the Great Depression, $90. He said, but we can buy them on time. We only have to pay $3 a month for the next 3 years. Well, my grandmother was not thrilled. She tried to get him to take these books back. He wouldn't. And fortunately, he didn't, because when I went off to get, the day that I was going to receive my PhD, my father gave me the 5 remaining leather-bound, gold-embossed books, the works of Dumas, the works of William Shakespeare, the works of Victor Hugo. My grandfather believed education was everything.
It's really amazing. So now your father actually was very similar to his father, and he wasn't on the spot forced into becoming a Presbyterian minister, but he did become a Republican under similar kinds of circumstances.
Yes, yes.
So why don't you tell a little bit how your dad became a Republican and how he followed in his father's footsteps.
Yes, well, my father and my mother went to register to vote in 1952. They were not yet married, but they went down to get together to register to vote. And they had in those days poll tests, someone who would actually ask black voters questions before you could register to vote. And the poll tester asked my mother, who was light-skinned, beautiful woman, so who was the first president of the United States? And she said, George Washington. He said, fine, you go register. Then he turned to my father and he said, how many beans are in that jar? And there were hundreds of beans in the jar. And he said, my father said, I don't know. You don't pass the test. So my father went back to his church. He was very upset. And an elderly man named Mr. Frank Hunter said, you know, Reverend, I'll show you how to get registered. He said, you go down there, and there's one of those clerks who is a Republican, and she's trying to build the party. Now, you didn't register by party affiliation, but this woman clearly would ask people, what are you? And if you said you're a Republican, she'd just register you. And then she kind of expected you to join the party, which my father then did. And he registered, he became a Republican, he was a lifelong Republican after that.
You know, actually, the black population in America tends to vote Democratic, and yet you have remained a Republican. What is your feeling about the Democrats, and why is it that you have stayed on the Republican side?
Well, actually, I started as a Democrat. I first registered to vote. I couldn't vote in 74. I wasn't old enough. And then in 76, when Jimmy Carter ran for office, he, for me, meant reconciliation of North and South. I voted for Jimmy Carter, but it was actually foreign policy that led me to become a Republican. I was very unhappy after the invasion of Afghanistan by the Soviet Union that the best that we could do was to boycott the Olympics. And I was therefore attracted to Ronald Reagan's somewhat tougher stance toward the Soviet Union. Became a Republican a couple of years later, not right away, but a couple of years later. And I'm comfortable in the Republican Party. Look, I don't like everything in the Republican Party. And one of the reasons I'm glad to be an American is this woman can say whatever she wishes and be safe to say it. And so I believed very strongly that the Republican Party, while it by no means and certainly has a lot to, from my point of view, atone for the Southern strategy in 1964 when the Civil Rights Act passed, the Republican Party tried to capitalize on that by going to Southerners who were unhappy about desegregation. The Republican Party has a lot to atone for on that. But frankly, I think that the emphasis on the individual rather than the group, I'm not very fond of identity politics. I know that there are challenges from being female, there are challenges from being black, but one should not say the group, the blacks, the minorities, the women. Let's see how individuals respond to their circumstances. And if there's one thing I really learned from my parents, it's that you may not be able to control your circumstances, but you can control how you respond to them.
That's true. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Dr. Condoleezza Rice, former U.S. Secretary of State. Just a couple more questions on Birmingham. You were there during the violence in the final breakthrough to integration down there, and you had friends who were killed. And how has that shaped your career, and how did it impact your attitude about violence?
Well, in Birmingham, this little parallel society that I had described in 62 and 63, it wasn't possible any longer, really, to shield the children of Birmingham. Birmingham became known as Bombingham. Bombs were going off in neighborhoods almost every night. One went off in our neighborhood. I'll never forget driving home and hearing the thud, and my father immediately turning the car around, and my mother saying, "Where are you going?" And he said, "I'm going to go to the police." And she said, "They probably set it off." And so you didn't feel safe at all in Birmingham. And in September of 1963, then, we were at church. And we'd gone early because my mother was the choir master, my father was the minister, and there was a loud thud. And everybody in Birmingham knew that that was a bomb. There just wasn't any doubt. But we didn't know where until a woman came in. They'd received a phone call. 16th Street Baptist Church had been bombed. They were worried that there might be coordinated bombings across many churches.
What about the bombings of Iraqi children? Responsible for millions of deaths. How can you sleep at night, Ms. Rice? I'm sorry, everyone.
Again, I sleep just fine in our democracy, and I hope that the people of Baghdad will do the same. And so we were watching. And so we were watching to see whether or not bombs were going to be going off across the city. And we heard pretty soon that indeed this bomb had gone off in the basement where little girls had been getting ready for Sunday school. And the names then became known. And one of them was Denise McNair, who had been my kindergarten classmate. And there's a picture in the book of this little girl being given a certificate of graduation from kindergarten by my father. So that's how close we were to those little girls. And at that point, you knew that Birmingham was not going to, the police were not going to protect you. And my parents, my father, along with other men in the community, formed shotgun brigades. And they would literally go to the head of the community and scare off night riders, although they never shot anybody, but they did shoot into the air quite a lot.
It's really, it's almost hard to put our heads back into it in the United States.
Yeah, you know? Seems like a very long time ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So then at age 12, your father took a position with the University of Denver, administrative position, and you left Birmingham. And what was that transition like, going into a mostly white community?
It's funny, I don't remember thinking terribly much about it. I was just glad that we were moving to Denver where I could skate year-round, because my parents and I started going to Denver in the summers. Back in 1960, my dad had decided he wanted to go into university work, and he needed to get a master's degree in something called Student Personnel Administration. The University of Denver had a very good program. So we would pack up the family car every summer, as soon as school ended. We would drive to Denver, and then it was a question of what to do with me. And one day I saw the figure skaters coming out in their little short skirts, and I had watched Tinley Albright, and I said, I want to go to skating school. So it became high-priced childcare. You could drop me off at the rink, and my parents could go to school. And I just loved to skate. So my dad kept going. He finally decided he was never going to finish just going in the summers. So he took a year's leave from Stoneman College, where he was now dean of students. The family moved for what was to be a temporary year to Denver. And when my dad finished his degree, a man named Maurice Mitchell, who had been standing in the parking lot with my father through all those skating hours, because Maurice Mitchell's daughter, Debbie, was a skater with me, so it shows you how coincidences happen. And so he was offered a job at the University of Denver. We moved. From my point of view, this was the best possible news, because now I could skate year-round. When I went back to Alabama before, I practiced skating on the floor, but you can only get so good skating on the floor. And I was delighted to move to Denver.
That's great. And at Denver, you were able to go to college at a fairly early age.
Yes.
And what was that experience like? You were 15?
I was. I started, I went to St. Mary's Academy in Denver, which was a college prep school for girls, Catholic college prep school. Wore those uniforms, you know, watch plaid skirts, knee socks, saddle shoes. Yes, there are pictures of it in the book if you want to see. And St. Mary's was a great place to go to school, but in my senior year, my parents, knowing that I was going to be a music major, suggested that I actually skip my last year of high school and start college. I didn't like the idea, and so we came up with a hybrid. I went to college in the morning and high school in the afternoon. And so I did my senior year in high school and my freshman year in college coterminously.
You know, Madeleine Albright was here last year, and I asked her, or I guess it was 2 years ago, and I asked her what she thought of your career as Secretary of State, and she said that she really didn't like talking about sitting Secretaries of State, so I guess it was just before you stepped down. But she said that she had the utmost respect for you and that you shared a father. And
yes.
She was talking about her biological father and your academic father.
Yes, yes.
So I know you write about Joseph Corbell in the book. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about him.
Yes, sure. Well, I have to set the story up just a little bit. I had studied piano from the age of 3. I was going to be a concert pianist, no doubt about it. In the summer after my sophomore year, I went to the Aspen Music Festival School to study, and I met prodigies who could play from sight what it had taken me all year to learn. I was 17, they were 12, and I thought, now that she's finished, and so I went to the Aspen Music Festival School, and these kids could play better than I would ever play. And I thought, I'm about to end up teaching 13-year-olds to murder Beethoven, or maybe playing piano bar, or maybe I'll play at Nordstrom, but there is no chance that I'm going to play Carnegie Hall. And so I went back home, and I said to my parents, I'm changing my major. And my father said, what are you changing your major to? And I said, I don't know. He said, you don't know what you're going to do with your life. I said, that's right, it's my life. He said, that's right, it's our money. So find a major. And so I went back to college in desperate search of a major. I wandered into a course after trying English literature, didn't work. State and local government, didn't work. A course in my junior year in the spring quarter, so it's now quite late, taught by Joseph Corbell in international politics. And it was like finding love. All of a sudden, I had found what I really wanted to do. I wanted to be a Soviet specialist. He was a Soviet specialist. So I went back and I told my parents I'm going to be a Soviet specialist. Fortunately, they didn't say, what's a nice black girl from Birmingham talking about being a Soviet specialist? They sort of said, go for it, and I did. But without Dr. Corbell, I would never have probably entered the field.
Yeah. And then you graduated from college, obviously, at a fairly young age. I'm sure, competence and luck, you had some good opportunities, including a fellowship at Stanford.
Yes.
And you've often said that you were an affirmative action hire. And I'd be interested both in your experiences at Stanford, but also what your attitude is about affirmative action generally.
Yeah. Well, I went to Stanford on a fellowship at the Arms Control and Disarmament Program. That shows you how long ago it was. Gloria Duffy, the CEO of the Commonwealth
in
Club,
the first row.
Was one of the other fellows in that program. In fact, the Stanford program had never had a female fellow, and all of a sudden there were four of us. Gloria, a woman named Jan Nolan, Cindy Roberts, and myself. And so I found myself at Stanford finishing my dissertation at Stanford and studying the kind of details of international security policy. And Stanford came to me through the political science department. They'd heard me give a talk and said, would you be interested in a faculty position? It was going to be what was called a term position at the time. You stay 3 years and then you're done. And pretty soon it kept going, and now it was going to be a regular tenure line position. And I finally, you know, I didn't know the ins and outs of universities at that time, but it finally occurred to me what Stanford was doing. Stanford had found a black woman Soviet specialist that they liked. They didn't need another Soviet specialist. In fact, they had 3 at the time. But I think they decided that they wanted to diversify the faculty, and here was somebody who could do that. They took, in that sense, a risk, because Stanford did not usually get its faculty from the University of Denver, but rather from like schools like Harvard and Yale and so forth. But it said to me that this was affirmative action at its best, and I've told the story many times because it worked out fine for me, it worked out okay for Stanford, and in fact what it was broadening the pool of people that you look to broaden and diversify the faculty. I don't personally believe in quotas, but I do believe, 25% of this and 10% of that, but I absolutely believe that it is both legitimate and smart to look outside of your normal channels and to take a few chances. Now, they also made it very clear that when we came up for tenure, there would be no special circumstances. And I also agree with that, because I think affirmative action ought to be an opportunity for equal access, but not a guarantee of outcomes.
I think it's very, clear that from coming out of Birmingham in the 60s to get to Stanford was definitely a circuitous route.
It certainly was, yes.
Affirmative action was probably necessary.
Well, and it was a circuitous route, and when my students ask me, which they often do, well, how do I get to do what you've done? And, they mean the Secretary of State. And I say, well, you start as a failed piano major, and you go from there. Because really, my story is one that you cannot plan every step in life. And I think it's an important message to kids who'd like to plan every step these days.
So after a couple years at Stanford, you were tapped under the first Bush president to become the director of Soviet and Eastern European Affairs at the National Security Council.
Yes.
And that was a very interesting time, the opening of the USSR and the fall of the Berlin Wall. Could you just talk a little bit about some of the things that you got to see from the front row?
Well, it was Brent Scowcroft who would become the National Security Advisor who sort of plucked me out of a crowd in a seminar at Stanford. And when he was made National Security Advisor for President George H.W. Bush, I went back with him. And I had no idea that as the Soviet specialist in the White House, from 1989 to 1991, I would witness everything from the liberation of Eastern Europe, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the beginnings of the collapse of the Soviet Union itself. It was an extraordinary time. But, I had to keep reminding myself that we were fortunate. We were at the end of a big historical epoch. The Soviet Union was largely a spent force by that time. And the good decisions, the tough decisions, had been made in 1946 and 1947 and 1948 when Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union were astride Europe when the Soviet Union exploded a nuclear weapon 5 years ahead of schedule in 1949. Nobody would have believed that you were going to have the collapse of the Soviet Union December 25th, 1991. Hammer and sickle comes down for the last time. Communism, never mind. And what it taught me is that history has a long arc, not a short one. And so I was lucky enough to be in the White House on 11-9 when the Berlin Wall fell. And then I was in the White House on 9-11 for the start of another big historical epoch.
As you sit here today, what would be your perspective on the future of Russia as it's transformed since you were in that job?
Well, Russia, by the way, when people say BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, I think that Russia actually doesn't fit. Russia is going through a very difficult period. It's a big oil and gas extractive industries economy that's just fine when the price of oil is $140 a barrel and not so great when it's 70. And it is really in a struggle for what it's going to become. On the one hand, it's become quite authoritarian over the last several years. On the other hand, you begin to hear murmurs, particularly from its president, Dmitry Medvedev, that Russia needs to be something different. Russia needs to be a place where the knowledge revolution is led. The Russians will remind you that they have some of the best software engineers in the world. Their problem is the great majority of them are working in Israel and the United States. And the question is, how do they harness all that talent to let Russia take its natural and proper place in the international economy? So I'm hoping that there is now room for a different Russia, a Russia that's not so dominated by authoritarian tendencies, by statist economic policies, and the growth, at least. You will remember that President Medvedev was here in the Silicon Valley trying very much to see how to build the Silicon Valley of Russia. And so perhaps that is changing, because Russia is a place where the human potential is great, but where the human capital is diminishing. It's a country where 140 million Russians within 25 to 30 years could be 100 million Russians because of the mortality, morbidity rates, and the low birth rates.
Now, at the end of your service, I know that President Bush wanted you to stay on, but you wanted to come back to Stanford,
yeah.
And you did, and you came back, and you were the provost of Stanford, which is essentially the second highest job in the university at a very young age.
Yes.
What was that like as a young black woman?
Well, I was 38, and I was the first black woman and 38, and I'd never been a department chair, let alone the provost. And I remember when we were getting ready for the announcement, and Terry Shepard, who was the public affairs officer, vice president, said, well, we're going to emphasize the fact that you've been running U.S.-Soviet relations, and that'll give people some confidence. They said, yeah, but Gorbachev doesn't have tenure. And it was, as it turns out, really didn't have tenure. But in any case, I really loved the job. I found that I took to the management of a great big institution like Stanford. The provost is like the chief operating officer. You have budgets, you have lands management, you have the kind of internal workings of the university, and I loved it. And when I became Secretary of State with 55,000 people worldwide, I was very grateful for the management experience that I'd had as provost.
I can imagine. So your book ends at the death of your father, just at the time that George W. Bush was elected. And I've got a number of questions in these on these cards about whether you were going to do another book and talk about those years.
Yes, I will. I will very much. As a matter of fact, I'm writing now the book. I actually had to make a decision. What did I want to write about first? And people ask me so often, how did you become who you are? And I say, you had to know John and Angelina Rice. And so I wanted people to know John and Angelina Rice and my story wrapped in theirs. But now I look forward to writing the book about the 8 years when we were in office, turbulent years, trying years, but years for which I would give nothing, because it was a very hard time for the country after September 11th. And you know, you do some things well, you do some things not so well, but I hope to be able to tell the story of the beginning of that next great historical epoch and where I think it's left us.
At the 20,000-foot level, how would you assess the Bush presidency?
Oh, I am a big believer that history, as I said, has a long arc, and those assessments will come long after probably I'm even gone. But I hope that people will remember, first of all, that if you told me on September 12th that there wasn't going to be another attack on the United States of America after September 11th, I would have said not possible. And it was not easy to defend the country, and we did so thanks to intelligence officers, we did so thanks to Homeland Security people, we did so thanks to the men and women in uniform who volunteer to defend us on the front lines of freedom. And so I'm very grateful for that. I'm also grateful that we were able to speak out for the proposition that no man, woman, or child should have to live in tyranny. The United States of America has to speak for that. And, you know, the moral case for democracy should be very clear, but there's also a practical case. I guess she's done. I absolutely would stand for that proposition, not just because it's a moral case, but because there's a practical case for democracy as well. Now, you know, we've been witnessing democracy at its noisiest. But let's remember something. Democracy at its noisiest is preferable to the silence of authoritarianism. And the great thing about democracy, which is what makes it ultimately stable, is that if the American people are tired enough of their government, if the British people are tired enough of their government, if the Colombian people or the Chilean people are tired enough of their government, and today, ultimately, if the Afghan people or the Iraqi people are tired enough of their government, they can throw the bombs out and they can do it peacefully. And that's the great genius of democracy.
As you sit here today, and obviously hindsight is very different than foresight, but looking back to the events of September 11th and the actions that followed, would you do something differently?
Oh, I'm sure there are many things that we would do differently, but September 11th was such a shock to the system of the United States of America, and I mean the gut of the United States of America, because we hadn't experienced an attack on our territory really since the White House burned in 1812, and in the War of 1812. But we had to gather ourselves, and we had to find a way to defend the country that would not change who we are. And I think essentially we succeeded at that. The very fact that we can now go back and question and second guess and tear apart the decisions that were made on September 12th or September 15th or for that matter in January of 2002 is a very good sign that the attacks themselves have receded in memory. But the reason that we were able to allow them to recede in memory is because people were vigilant after September 11th. People broke up the organization that did 9/11. Al-Qaeda is still a threat, but it is not the organization that carried out September 11th. We have in Afghanistan gone after the sanctuary of Al-Qaeda. And while Afghanistan is very tough, and it was always going to be tough, it's the fifth poorest country in the world. It's not the country that it was in September of 2001 when Al-Qaeda was hiding and plotting and planning inside of Afghanistan, when women were being executed in soccer stadiums in Afghanistan, when the Taliban was able to play host to all of that terrorism. It's a different country now. And so, yes, I'm sure in retrospect there will be many of things. But given what we faced on September 11th, I think the record is frankly pretty good. And the ultimate piece that I would point to is there wasn't another attack after September 11th, and there was no guarantee of that.
You know, one thing you pointed out in your book, or you recognized at the time you agreed to go into the administration of George W. Bush, that his weak suit in terms of experience was his international foreign affairs experience. How did he develop in that regard over the years that you knew him as president, and do you think it had any negative effects that that wasn't something he was really experiencing?
No, I think most of our presidents come to power, governors, for instance, and I think the most important things that you bring to the presidency is, first of all, a set of principles and values that you're going to defend. Secondly, decision-making skills, knowing how to ask difficult questions, knowing how to prioritize, knowing how to get people around you who are good people and who will tell you the truth. I mean, those are the important skills that you bring. And it's not long before any president of the United States knows the details of his foreign policy, before any president of the United States knows every other leader and what they stand for. It's in the normal course of events that they become quite expert on foreign policy. And so I think when you come to power, if you come to power with strong principles and with good people around you and with a set of good decision-making skills, you'll be just fine.
One comment you made in the press, I think it was this week, was that that you even today would say that Hussein had to be taken out of power, but that you might have had a different approach to the rebuilding of Iraq. I wonder if you could address that, and also what maybe should have been done with respect to Iran in those years that might not have been done.
Well, with respect to Iran, to take that first, I actually think that we put in place the machinery that is still being used and ultimately might solve the Iranian problem. This was to bring together the P5 plus one, it was called, which is the permanent members of the Security Council, Russia, China, the UK, the UK, France, and the United States, with Germany, which had been negotiating on behalf of the European Union, and to try to get Security Council sanctions that would force the Iranian regime to make different choices than it had been making. And while the Security Council resolutions and the sanctions were not that strong, they did create a kind of halo by which other countries are doing stronger things than the sanctions themselves. And the Iranian economy is now struggling. It's struggling from the twin hits of the sanctions and the fact that Ahmadinejad made very bad economic decisions. That, plus the fact that that regime is now quite weak internally, you could keep a skeleton in place a long time with coercion, but that regime has no legitimacy with its own people. And if you realize that 70% of the people of Iran are under the age of 30, this is a place that is going to change. And so I believe Iran, we did a job of setting it up, and I hope that it will come to fruition. As to Iraq, what I've said is that we very much tried to build Iraq from Baghdad out. And I think in retrospect, the strength of building it from the outside in would have meant that you were building provinces that were capable of defending themselves, like Al-Anbar turned out to be capable of defending itself. You would have had reconstruction projects that were smaller in scale, probably easier to manage, probably less subject to the kinds of attacks that the big projects had. And the governance might have been easier from the outside in. That said, I think that the fact that the conversation, and look, I understand, let me be very clear, the lives lost there, whether Iraqi or American or other coalition, can never be brought back. And I understand that fully, and the sacrifice is something that I have to live with. I also know that nothing of value is ever won without sacrifice. And I know that the conversation today about Iraq is not the conversation that it was in 1998 or 1999 or 2000. What is Saddam Hussein doing? Is he going to use weapons of mass destruction again, as he had twice? When is he next going to invade his neighbors, as he did twice? When is he going to finally get lucky and shoot down an American aircraft patrolling his aircraft? It would have eventually happened. How long will it be before oil for food is exposed as the complete scandal that it was? We now know it was a scandal. That was the conversation about the cancer that was Saddam Hussein. And now the conversation is, can Sunni and Shia take the results of a free election in Iraq and form a government? That's a different conversation.
True. I know that... I believe you met with President Obama this week, and I just was wondering if you could give some perspective on how you think the Obama administration has been doing in the foreign policy arena, and if there's anything you could tell us about your meeting, that would be great, too.
I can tell you that I gave him a copy of my book, and I gave him a copy of the young adult version for Sasha and Malia, so that's what I can tell you about the meeting. It was a very kind invitation from the president to sit down and visit about foreign affairs. The nice thing is it's actually not that unusual that presidents will call back cabinet secretaries, particularly on the foreign policy side, where I think we still do have a belief that when we're talking about the security of the United States or the foreign policy of the United States or American leadership, we ought to try at least to reach across the aisles and be as bipartisan as possible. And so I welcomed the opportunity to talk with the president. As I've said, I don't agree with everything that's been done in the Obama administration, but I know these people. They are patriots. Hillary Clinton, I first met when she brought her daughter to Stanford when I was provost. Bob Gates is a long, long time friend. And so they're doing their best. And I know one thing, it's a whole lot harder in there than it is out here. And so I'm determined that if I have things to say to them that I would do differently, I'll tell them directly.
How do you see Hillary Clinton in the job that you had for so long?
She's doing a fine job. You know, she's a patriot. She understands the importance of defending American interests. And it's a hard job. You know, you're always on a plane to someplace. I flew a million miles as Secretary of State. And you're just getting off the plane hoping that you're not going to say that you're in a country that you're not actually in, because you're sometimes never quite sure of where you are. And the other thing that's hard about that job is that you hear people talk a lot about the decline of American power and the irrelevance of American power. Don't believe it. Every time there is a major issue, even sometimes extremely minor issues to be resolved, people come to the American Secretary of State and say, we can't do this without the United States. And you say, surely you can do this without the United States. And so it's a job, because it's a difficult job, because it is the address for almost every problem in the world.
Obviously, President Obama is a different party than you are, but how did it make you feel that a black man was elected president of the United States?
Well, the day of the election, I actually went down to the State Department press room just to say how extraordinary it was and how proud it made me as an American, because it said that America is everything that it claims to be. And we've been getting there. We've been inching there for a while, I think. First black chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Said, yes, the highest-ranking military officer can be black. You had back-to-back black secretaries of state. The highest-ranking diplomat of the United States of America can be black. And then another tremendous leap, the president of the United States. And I think it says that perhaps we're never going to be colorblind as a country. I think that's asking too much of a country that has the deep racial wounds that we have, that has the birth defect of slavery. We are perhaps less quick to think we know what that person can be by looking at their color. And that's a big step forward, that we're no longer defining roles by color. So I thought that it was a tremendous moment. And it said one other thing that I've carried with me, not just from that experience, but as Secretary of State. The great thing about institutions, democratic institutions, constitutions and the like, is that while they may not at the very beginning really be true for a people, they do stand there as the ought, as George Shultz would call it. They stand there as what it is supposed to be. So whether it was Frederick Douglass or Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks, they did not have to tell the United States of America that it ought to be something different. They simply had to say that the United States of America ought to be what it said that it was. And that's why democratic institutions are so important.
Thank you. You know, there's the Tea Party movement on the Republican side, and there have been some reports of racism in that movement. How do you feel about the Tea Party, and how do you respond to the racist parts of it?
Look, there are extremist expressions in almost every movement, and I have learned not to tar an entire group of people with the brush because they're extremist. I think that the Tea Party is a grassroots movement. I think that it is a grassroots movement that has come about because people look at what they're seeing, and they don't know really what's happening to their country, and they are unnerved by it. And in fact, they're saying to people in Washington, the conversation in Washington and the conversation out here in the rest of the country is not the same conversation. Do you understand that? And I think that's actually important. And so while I may not agree with everything that is said either by the Tea Party or in the name of the Tea Party, since it's a quite diverse group, I am certainly more pro-immigration. I am certainly more pro-free trade. but I will defend the right of these people not just to say it, but to organize on the basis of it. That's what grassroots politics is all about. And if it gets the attention of a federal government that's sometimes a little disconnected from its constituencies, so be it.
You know, one other perpetual hotspot, of course, is Israel and Palestine. There's obviously been some things happening recently. What's your perspective on what's going on, and what do you think the chances are of a real breakthrough?
Well, I actually think the chances are eventually, I don't want to define eventually, going to be pretty good, because the fundamentals have changed in this conflict over the last several years. First of all, the Israelis used to say, well, we need a partner for peace. Well, there actually is a partner for peace. It's the Palestinians who have clearly are no longer going to turn to terrorism and violence, who want to negotiate a solution. You see it in the West Bank, where Salam Fayyad, the prime minister, has built good, solid democratic institutions, good, solid security forces, which the United States helped to build, where the economy in the West Bank is actually growing very rapidly. You see what that Palestinian state could look like. Secondly, you see in Israel a broadening of the base of people who believe in the two-state solution. In 2000, at Camp David, when Ehud Barak pursued the peace negotiations, it was really only labor in Israel that was committed to the two-state solution. Then Ariel Sharon in 2003 committed to the two-state solution, and then Ehud Olmert, who actually made a pretty good offer to the Palestinians, and then now Benjamin Netanyahu. So with the exception of the far right in Israel, there now is a commitment to the two-state solution. And finally, the Arabs want this solved because they have figured out that there is a problem in the Middle East, and it starts with I, but it's not Israel, it's Iran. And they would like to have this Palestinian issue, which Iran is stirring the pot in places like Gaza, off the table. And so the big players, the Palestinians, the Israelis, the Arabs, I think, are there. Now, it's going to take some hard work because they're still very sticky issues. But for me, the real question is, can the Palestinians, who have not perhaps told their people that there is not going to be a right of return of 4 million refugees to Israel, that's going to be taken care of inside the Palestinian state, that Jerusalem is going to have some kind of sovereignty for both peoples, and perhaps most importantly, that a lot of those settlements that are really big cities are going to stay in the state of Israel. I think once that's accepted, a deal is possible.
How long do you think it'll take?
I said I wasn't going to define eventually, but I don't rule out that it could be done in the year that the administration has set. I don't rule it out.
Well, let's all hope for that. I've got a number of questions wondering if you plan to run for political office.
No, that's an easy one. look, I never ran for student council, you'll see in the book. And you know how you're asked, do you want to do this? And you say the time isn't right. And pretty soon you realize maybe the time's not going to be right. I will continue to do public service. I'm very involved in K-12 education. I'm very involved with the Boys and Girls Clubs. And other important causes. I think that's how I'll do my public service.
Sounds like a good contribution. So going back to your childhood and to the south of the United States, I have a question about whether you could ever live in Birmingham now and what you see as the how far we have come on these basic issues of racism, especially in the south.
Well, perhaps I can best illustrate this with a little vignette. I was back in Birmingham in 2003, and my aunt, who is my aunt by marriage, gave a little party for me, and she invited a lot of my school friends and former teachers and so forth. So of course, the whole party was black because it was segregated in those days. But the caterers were white, and I said to my aunt, how'd you choose the caterers? And she said, oh, this little girl in my school, she teaches, she said, this little girl in my school, her mother formed a little catering company, and I thought I'd give her a chance. And I thought, well, that's a perfectly logical explanation, but completely out of bounds for the Birmingham that I knew and the Birmingham that we left at the end of the 1960s. And so that little vignette says something about how far Birmingham has come. It has had successive black mayors. It has had city council, people on the city council, including my childhood friend Carol Smitherman. Police chief, a couple of people removed. In other words, Eugene Bull Connor's direct successor was a black woman. And so Birmingham has come a long way. And while I don't expect that I would move back to Birmingham for reasons of having to do with having become a Californian 30 years next year, it's a quite different place. And Birmingham is aware of its past. It is trying to heal those wounds. And it's a very good lesson of how much people and places can change. And it's a very good lesson when we get impatient with peoples that are trying to find their way to democracy, and we think, oh, why can't they get it right? Who are we to be impatient when you think that my father had trouble registering to vote in 1952?
Yeah, good point. You know, you've had some very synchronistic connections with some of the other secretaries of state, like Madeleine Albright and Colin Powell, and I just wondered if you could give us your perspective on the different styles of Madeleine, Colin, and yourself, and what difference those stylistic points make in being Secretary of State?
Well, I think everybody does the job differently, obviously, because we're all different people. And the time at which you happen to be in office also matters a great deal. Colin Powell, who was a terrific Secretary of State and one of the people that I admire most in America, was Secretary of State in wartime. That's different than when you are, as I was as Secretary of State, coming in to try and fashion a peace and to bring our allies into that peace. Madeleine was Secretary of State during a period in which I think there was a kind of transition from the Cold War to what would become September 11th, and what one thought about in terms of interest was somewhat more nebulous in that period of time. So I tend to think that it has more to do with when you're there, because secretaries of state all have a couple things in common. You know, as I said, they're going to be on the road all the time. They're going to be the address all of the time for whatever problems are out there. It matters a lot how your relationship is with the President of the United States. But for the most part, what people often see as stylistic differences, I think, probably have more to do with the time in which you're Secretary of State than anything in the personalities.
You know, as you sit here looking out over the world, with the deep knowledge you have, both academic and just practical, and the jobs that you've had, what are you worried about over the next 5 years? What areas of the world do you think have the potential for erupting?
Well, you know, on the list are the ones that you would expect. We've got to get Afghanistan and Pakistan right, obviously. We don't want Afghanistan to become a failed state again and end up harboring terrorists. But, you know, there's a place that I worry quite a lot about just south of here, Mexico. I think that there are elements of northern Mexico or places in northern Mexico that resembled a failed state, where the police are not really reliable, where the army is trying to play the role of the police, where the drug lords are better armed, if anything, than the army, where the Mexican government knows that it has problems of control. You know, in 2008, our last year in office, the Mexican government had 5,000 kidnappings and assassinations of officials. And there's some thought that it may be double that. You're seeing some of the more high-profile attacks. So I think we need to worry about that, because Mexico is not just our neighbor. It is a neighbor that has made a real transition to democracy, and it would be a pity if the drug wars ultimately were to roll back into Mexico and destabilize the country as a whole. So that's a place to watch.
We unfortunately have reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question, and I got this question from a number of our audience, which is, what was your proudest moment as Secretary of State, and what was your biggest disappointment?
Well, my biggest disappointment actually was that we were unable to get immigration reform, frankly. You know, when you have a bill that John McCain, George W. Bush, and Ted Kennedy all want, and you can't get it through, you know, it's easy to demagogue that issue. And it was something I'd worked on with Mexico. I think it goes at the core of who we are as a people, a place of country of immigrants. And so, frankly, that was my biggest disappointment. I was disappointed we couldn't do more for the people of Sudan and so forth. But for the future of this country, I think immigration reform is an absolute necessity. And I think my proudest moments had to do whenever I watched the flowering of democracy in places that it had never been. And I can remember, in particular, going to the Middle East and realizing how much things were starting to change, particularly for women. You know, if I could do one thing, I would empower women, because it changes the character of a place. And even in the most conservative Middle East places, where a Shia cleric, very conservative Shia cleric, couldn't shake my hand because I was a woman, at some point he would say, "Could you just stay for a minute? I want you to meet my 13-year-old granddaughter." And some little covered girl would come out, and she would say, "I want to be foreign minister too." And her grandfather would just beam. And I would think, you know, despite his prejudices, he wants something different for his granddaughter. And I think therein lies the hope that even in places where tyranny has ruled and certainly women have been treated as chattel, things are changing. And so since I'm an optimist about human beings and how we ultimately deal with these things, anything that I watched that was just a glimmer of that made me very proud to represent a country that stood for those values.
Thank you, Secretary Rice. We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Today's program has been underwritten by the Corrett Foundation as part of the Commonwealth Club's Principles of a Free Society series. And I'm Mary Cranston, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you are in the know, is adjourned.